Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, darling. Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. Good morning, everyone. This is Jeffrey Swartz, Professor Jeffrey Swartz, with my compatriot, Professor Brendan Berry. And we are professorial at WMU Cooley Law School, Tampa Bay campus. And before we go any further, I'm supposed to say, and I will say, that the opinions that Brendan and I espouse today, and there are going to be a lot of them, as usual, are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School, its faculty, either at large or individually. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Jeffrey. How you doing? Stop calling me darling.
And I wasn't calling you darling. You don't have the voice. Okay. And the other laughter there is our friend and mentor and always there with the appropriate question when the time comes, Hezzy Harris. Good morning, Hezzy. How are you today?
Good morning. A pleasure to hear you guys today.
It's a pleasure to be heard. You know, it's like I always say, I wake up in the morning, and if I'm looking down at the grass and not up at the dirt, it's a good day. And it's kind of the way I look at it. And then I verify by checking the obits and making sure my name isn't there. So it's
very introspective. I never thought of it that deeply.
You gotta have verification in these things. Okay, that's why I get verification. Okay, so I've got to have the verification. So that's about as funny as I can be this morning. I'd like to be funny this morning. I really would. It's a beautiful day down here. The sun is shining on a cloud in the sky, all the things that go with it. But there is nothing funny happening, at least in the ha-ha way. There are funny things happening, but I think it has a different connotation. And Brendan and I speak every morning for about 45 minutes every Tuesday morning and kind of go through what we want to talk about today. And it took us an hour just to come up with everything that we wanted to talk about today. So that means we're not going to talk about everything we want to talk about.
Right.
But we start out the program each of us gets a segment that we call What Do I Really Think? And I have just been struggling with what I want to talk about. And since we're going to talk about just about everything I want to talk about and Brendan wants to talk about today, at least as much as we can fit into an hour, I want to go for the low-hanging fruit. And the low-hanging fruit is a guy from California who wants to be the next Speaker of the House, and that's Kevin McCarthy. I want to put this simply. This is a guy who will say whatever he thinks he has to say to whoever he has to say it to at any one moment to look like he is a leader and will reverse course the next day to look like a leader. And yet he leads nothing. This is a guy who wants to be third in line for the presidency of the United States, who wouldn't know the truth if it was in a whipped cream pie that hit him in the face. Mm-hmm. He will say any lie he needs to say. He will equivocate on anything that he has to equivocate on. And somewhere along the line, being called out is not enough. He needs to be punished for what he does. This is a guy who, to look tough to his caucus, on January 11th, gets on a telephone in 2021, 5 days after the insurrection, to look like Mr. Tough Guy, in talking about Donald Trump, says, I've had it with this guy. and tells his caucus, I've had conversations with him, and he reads, and if you listen carefully to when he's speaking when he says this, he's reading like I'm going to read now. I asked him personally today, does he hold responsibility for what happened? Does he feel bad about what happened? He told me he does have some responsibility for what happened, and he'd need to acknowledge that. That is, one, either a lie to the people that were listening on this phone call, and a lie specifically to questions asked by the only truth speaker, or one of the few truth speakers left in the Republican caucus, Liz Cheney, or he's lying now when he says, I never asked him that question. He gets on and he says, we got to get rid of this guy. They're going to pass this proclamation to have him declared an insurrectionist and to invoke the 25th Amendment. I'm going to call him tonight and tell him he should resign. I don't think he will, but I have to tell him he's going to resign. Mr. Tough Guy, you're a tough guy, Kevin. You're a real tough guy. Because you always carry through with your threats, don't you? And yet 2 days later at a press conference, he is specifically asked by a member of the press in a press conference, is it true that on January 11th in a call to your caucus, you told your caucus that you had asked the President of the United States to resign from the presidency effective immediately? And he says, I don't know what call you're talking about. That was his answer. That's where Marjorie Taylor Greene learned, and we'll talk about this later, how to say, I don't remember. He doesn't remember having a call with his caucus and what they talked about. I don't know what call you're talking about. His lies started on the 13th. One has to wonder, what does Donald Trump really have on Kevin McCarthy? What does he really have on him that he would bend over so quickly and abandon his own caucus and lead his own caucus down the road of excusism? I just don't understand how the people of the state of California, the district that he comes from, would want him so badly to be speaker that they would put third in line to the presidency of the United States a man who lies and says, I never said those things from a report that is published by the New York Times and is part of a book that's being published. Say, I never said those things. That's make-believe. I never said that. And the next day, the tapes come out. Somebody in his caucus taped him when he was saying these things and gave it to the New York Times. And doesn't come out immediately and say, I'm sorry, I lied to all of you. He ignores it and moves on to something else because this will pass. It falls on you. The people in California from the district that he represents, is this what you really want to be known for? By putting one of the greatest liars in American politics into possibly being the Speaker of the House of Representatives, third in line to the presidency. Is this what you really want to be known for? Is this what you want the people of the United States to thank you for or to hate you for? I know you're not listening to this, but I'm speaking to everybody. I got to tell you something. If there is money to be spent, spend it out there. give as much money as you possibly can to any Democrat that wins the primary out there that runs against McCarthy. Someone who will literally stand up at a debate, which, of course, McCarthy probably won't show up for, and say, you, sir, are a liar, an out-and-out liar. You lie to the American people. You lie to your constituents. You don't belong in Congress. You actually probably belong in a jail cell. I know it's wishful thinking. Everybody's going to say, not going to happen. I understand. But something has to be done about this guy. Because the sad part is, if you don't get him, you might get Marjorie Taylor Greene as Speaker of the House. Boy, that would be a trip, wouldn't it? Talk about Republicans voting for Nancy Pelosi. I'm telling you, this guy is the worst. The absolute worst. I thought that John Boehner was bad. He was just weak. He never lied. He's just weak. McCarthy is weak and a liar, and he doesn't belong in American politics. Send him back to California to try to make an honest living, which, of course, he can't do because he isn't an honest man. And that's what I think.
Yeah. The lying is extraordinary, the level that it has reached in American politics. And as usual, before I pivot to another topic, I want to kind of, I don't know, hash out a little bit of what you said. He's not the only one, right? I mean, of course, Trump logged more lies, you know, in 4 years as president. I think the Washington Post lost track of the material, not just little ones. We have Marjorie Taylor Greene this week, and we'll get more into the substance of this later, but just on the subject of lying, asked under oath, did you say that Nancy Pelosi was a traitor to the United States? No, I never said that. The lawyer says, okay, put up Exhibit 5, and then she says, oh, wait. Okay, so she did. She got caught in a lie. I mean, a big lie. And Mark Meadows, we all know, is a liar. I want to also point out, you know, when we talk about Mark Meadows, that we now have these 2,000-plus texts that were sent to Mark Meadows on and around January 6th. And it is amazing the trove of text messages that we now see from Republican members of Congress who were texting Meadows, get Trump to call this off. Get Trump to stop this. This is out of control. Every one of them, this is the important point, every one of those members of Congress knew who was responsible for that mob. They weren't asking Antifa to call it off. They weren't asking the Capitol Police to take care of the tourists. They were texting the chief of staff, Donald Trump's chief of staff, asking him to get Trump to call it off. And then every one of them went out and lied about who was responsible for what happened on January 6th. Oh, it was Antifa. No, they didn't think it was Antifa. Oh, it was the FBI. The FBI planted people in there. They didn't think it was the FBI. They were asking Trump to call it off. They were just tourists. Why were you texting the chief of staff of the White House to make it stop if you think they were tourists? The lies are unbelievable. And here's what I don't want to hear anymore. Don't be the person who says this. Don't be the idiot who says this. All politicians lie. Who cares if they lie, right? Oh, all politicians lie. First of all, there are different things that people can lie about, okay? It's one thing for Bill Clinton to say, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. That was a lie. It was a lie about what? It was a lie about his sex life, okay? Something that was extremely embarrassing in his personal life. That's what he was lying about. Okay. We know that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. It's an entirely different species of lie. January 6th didn't happen. It's an entirely different order of magnitude kind of a lie. You say all politicians lie. So what? Tell me about what? Tell me what Barack Obama lied about. Oh, he said that everybody could keep their doctor. No, under Obamacare, that was a lie. That wasn't a lie. That was his understanding of how it would work. Okay, it might be something that didn't turn out exactly the way he thought it was, but it was what he thought. That's not the same as lying. Oh, he said, Barack Obama said there were 51 states. That's called a that's called a mental hiccup. That's not a lie.
Yeah.
What is Joe Biden lying about?
It's your brain passing gas is what it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
To put it politely. Right. It's, yeah. It's, yeah.
Okay.
But we talk about this all the time, Jeff, this false equivalence. Right. Oh, all politicians
right.
lie. Joe Biden is not lying. Okay, you might not like anything he does, but he's not lying to you. He's telling you what he really thinks. The facility with which these people lie, the Republicans, it's Putin-esque.
Well, I have to say this. That I looked at some of those texts from people who were then, you know, when things got what they considered to be totally out of hand. And the truth of the matter is they wrote those because they were scared. And they were scared because they're wearing congressional pins. And most people wouldn't know Marjorie Taylor Greene when she walked down the hall or not. No one would know Lauren Boebert when she's walking down the hall or not. No one would know who Paul Gosar is. No one would know who Louis Gohmert is. Mo Brooks they might remember because he just rabble-roused them. Okay? But the fact of the matter is that they were scared. They were frightened because it went farther than they thought it was going to go. It became dangerous. And on top of which, think about it this way. Could some of these been CYA? Wait a minute. I'm part of this. I helped them. Now it's gone this far, and I'm liable for what they did, so I got to ask for it to get called off to look like I'm against them. And do we really know if Marjorie Taylor Greene was the one who actually wrote that text? Could it have been a member of her staff? We don't know because she doesn't remember. Marjorie Taylor Greene doesn't remember, okay? It's sort of like I'm watching her, okay, going down the road singing "If I Only Had a Brain," okay. I mean, I mean, just straw sticking out from underneath her coat, you know. I can just envision this, okay. And we're going to talk more about Marjorie. And I don't remember because you know, I don't remember. But the bottom line is some of these people were frightened. And they were angry. And they felt, some of them may have said, wait a minute, I'm trying to help this guy and he's sicking the crowd on me? And so they're sitting here saying, oh, I better get out from under this shit. Sorry about that, folks. Beep. You know, I curse. Hezzy will put the beep in later. Okay. But I got to put it the way they said it. I mean, you can't fudge that one. I agree with you. The lying has reached a level that we're not lying about. You know, there used to be an adage that said, deny, deny, deny. And when they show you the pictures, keep denying. These people deny, deny, deny. When you show them the pictures, they change the subject. And I think that, that's the real problem here. And I don't want to hear that my congressman lied to me and said the taxes weren't going to go up on this or that. And they come home and say, well, it was passed by Congress and it's what we had to do. And, yeah, I told you I wouldn't do that. You know, read my lips. But this goes beyond that. And with McCarthy, this is like, if it's not McCarthy, you might as well put Paul Gosar in there. Make him Speaker of the House. I mean, if you're going to lie, let's get the number one liar in there. But it's bad. It's very, very bad. And the idea that this guy, you know, it almost, Nancy Pelosi provides cover for Biden and for Harris. Because if there's anybody that right-wingers hate more than Biden and Harris, it's Nancy Pelosi. And the idea that Nancy Pelosi would become president of the United States just scares the ever-living you-know-what out of them. But the idea, and I'm not saying that they're thinking it, but there's got to be far right-wingers that are thinking it, I can make Kevin McCarthy president of the United States. That scares the hell out of me. Because violence is okay with Trump's Republican Party. Get what you want any way you can get it. And that scares me. That really scares me.
Mm-hmm.
There is no scenario right now that a Republican would succeed to the presidency of the United States. There's not one Republican in line of succession right now. Not one. But if McCarthy gets there, that's a different story, isn't it? I just thought I'd throw that one out for food for thought.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. So,
and you're right.
Go ahead.
Violence is now okay. Violence is okay. And this group.
Was the lying thing your what you really think, or you got something else you want to talk about?
Well, I guess that was what I really think, but let's pivot to the next big topic of the day.
Okay. Yeah.
And that is the platform upon which Donald Trump did a lot of his lying. Twitter. yep.
Okay.
Yep. And Elon Musk.
Yeah.
Decided. I saw somebody wrote yesterday on Twitter, of all things, that Elon Musk has the wherewithal to end the problem of veteran homelessness overnight. Instead, he bought a social media platform. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this
he
is
can solve a
what
lot
he
of
decided
problems.
To spend his money on. Right. Right.
He can solve a lot of problems. He can end homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
He can feed the hungry. Okay. Elon Musk has the ability, together with many others, if you put the four richest people in the world together, all of them Americans, okay, if you put four people together, all of them Americans, you would have $1 trillion. Imagine what those four people could do with $1 trillion
mm-hmm.
and still have money left over.
Right.
And Elon Musk scares me for a lot of reasons because his thought process, he doesn't like democracy. This is not a man who likes democracy. He likes to rabble-rouse. He likes to be the center of attention. And he likes the idea that he can control things. And he wants to control Twitter. The only saving grace is that his owning Twitter will probably keep Donald off of Twitter because Donald hates Elon Musk. Because Elon Musk is everything Donald thinks he is, but isn't. Anybody that's richer than he is, he does not like. And that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
He ain't all that rich. I'll remind everybody, he has a 757 that is literally fallowing and rusting away. at an airport in New Jersey. Because he hasn't got the money to fix it. So, and that, I mean Donald, that is. So this is kind of a big deal because he is going to allow Donald back on. He's going to let all of these right-wing people, all of these people who've been thrown off, all of the liars and all of the conspiracy theorists who have nothing to back up what they're saying, people who lie about things that are happening and make stuff up, back onto Twitter. So it was an interesting article about this on CNN this morning that I read. It's called Who Will Be the First to Leave Twitter? Who will be the first to abandon Elon Musk's Twitter? Now, let's remember something. Elon Musk is borrowing this money. He doesn't have $44 billion in cash. Nobody has $44 billion in cash. The American government doesn't have $44 billion in cash. He doesn't have that cash. He has assets. He's going to have to leverage his car company, Tesla. Banks are going to have to lend him money for this $44 billion. He leverages an asset. And remember, Tesla, as I remember correctly, is a private company.
Mm-hmm, right.
He owns it.
Yeah, and SpaceX.
So he's going to have, and SpaceX too. He's going to have to leverage assets to come up with $44 billion. And bankers are going to be asking questions. What are you going to do? You're going to let the former guy back on? You're going to let on all of the conspiracy theorists again? You going to let Steve Bannon back on? If that's what you're going to do, we don't want to invest because you know why? Because women generally don't use Twitter. Did you know that? Women like Instagram and they like Facebook. They don't like Twitter. Men love Twitter. But there's a lot of these people who have felt safe on Twitter for the last 2 years. They're not going to feel safe on Twitter anymore. And they're going to start falling off. And whether he wants to believe it or not, it's those people that look at their advertising. It's those people that make Twitter what it is. And it's the people who follow Donald Trump, his 2 or 3 or 10 or 12 million people who follow his tweets. Tweet, tweet, tweet. Okay? Okay, don't buy anything except for a six-pack and shotgun shells. And so where is his income going to come from to support what he wants to do with Twitter? Elon Musk is not a philanthropist because if he was, take that $44 million, Elon, and start housing people and feeding people and do something good for this country that's been so good to you. Instead of trying to make it in the image that you think it should be. Like that little you-know-what Zuckerberg who thinks he's going to remake the world. Sorry. But no. So he's got a problem. And at a meeting yesterday of the staff of Twitter, the hierarchy, the people that really work there, they're scared to death of what Elon's going to do. He's going to find himself with his important people walking out the door. Because they don't want any part of Elon Musk's Twitter. And he overpaid, by the way. $54.20 per share was really mm-hmm. overpaid by about $15 per share. So instead of $44 million, he should have gotten it for $34 or $35 million. But the bottom line is he overpaid. He offered that much because he didn't want a battle that he couldn't lose. He wanted a battle he couldn't lose. I mean, so I don't know what he's going to do with it, but it scares the hell out of me.
Yeah.
He wants unfettered speech.
Mm-hmm. That's so much nonsense.
I wonder if he's going to be willing to take the absolute, and it started already, the absolute inundation of, and again, the swear word, crap about him that's being said on Twitter. Is he going to censor them? Is he that much of a believer that he's being attacked by everyone who has any conscience whatsoever about what he's doing to Twitter as they sit there and say, this is what I think about you, I'm leaving Twitter? Be interesting.
Yeah.
This guy's about money. And that stock is not going to stay at 54.20. That stock's going to drop. He's losing money. The minute he takes over, he's going to lose, I would say, anywhere from $10 to $12 billion. That's how fast that stock's going to drop. So we'll see how smart he thinks he is.
Mm-hmm.
See if it's really about free speech or whether it's about his pocketbook.
Yeah,
what do you
to the extent he says it's about free speech, it's utter nonsense. I always am very suspicious of absolutists when it comes to these, you know, Second Amendment rights or freedom of speech. That nobody has ever said that the First Amendment is an absolute, that it's licensed to say whatever you want. If that were so, we couldn't have conspiracy laws, right? If you can just say whatever you want, no matter the consequences, then there goes that.
You mean like commit sedition, like other people have recently?
Yes, right. All the sedition laws are out the window. Breach of the peace laws, right? You're not allowed to shout fire in a crowded theater unless there really is one. You're not allowed to imminently advocate for lawless activity. That's illegal in most jurisdictions. There are things you can't say. It's speech, but no, can't do it. And judges, you know, for the history of the Republic have said that. It's not an absolute.
I've said many times, that everything in the Bill of Rights is based upon a reasonableness standard.
Right, right.
Okay, you're not protected against all searches without a warrant, only unreasonable ones.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Everything is based on a reasonableness standard. Everything is subject to that. It isn't going to change. So don't tell me you have a right to say whatever you want to say. That is just not what is written in the Constitution.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Right, right. And besides that, okay, now a couple other ideas here. When you look at what was meant to be protected, right, when the people who drafted the First Amendment drafted it, they wanted to protect ideas, the expression of ideas, the marketplace of ideas, right, competing ideas, let them all out there. The problem is that with modern-day Republicans, they're not fighting about ideas. We're not debating ideas. This is not the marketplace of ideas that we're in anymore. It's a universe of alternative facts, which is actually an expression that's been used by Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
So to say, you know, speech, you know, all speech should be protected. You know, if we want to really think about that, that means the expression of ideas should be protected. And I have no problem with that. Donald Trump should be able to express whatever ideas he has about what? About what to do with Ukraine, about what to do about the economy, what to do about tax policy. I don't care if Donald Trump wants to express his ideas. I think that that is an absolute. You can absolutely express your thinking, your ideas about something. What do you think about a book, something you read?
If he has any.
That's right. Exactly. But that's not what's going on, right? We're not talking about expressing ideas on the Republican side. We're talking about propaganda intended to alter reality, to make people think that things that are not true are true. And that's not the same as – that's not the kind of speech our the founders were thinking about. I also would like to point out – because people just can't seem to understand this, including Elon Musk, right, taking over the country's leading social media platform because it's not allowing free speech, that's what he says, that the First Amendment, like the rest of the Bill of Rights, applies to the government, not private actors. The New York Times does not have to publish every letter to the editor it gets. The New York Times is not the government, okay? And they don't have to give you their platform to say whatever you want. I've been teaching law students this for years. Twitter is not a state actor. It is not capable of violating the First Amendment.
Nor is Facebook or any of the others.
Right. You don't like it? Get off of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's somebody else's platform.
Don't read it.
Yeah.
Don't read the Times. Don't read the Post. Don't read
right.
Any newspaper you don't like. You should
right.
read it
right.
so you can learn something, but if you don't like it, don't read it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, yeah, so a private social media platform needs to let Donald Trump back on so he can keep lying about factual matters. Okay. The entire thing is idiocy. He's an idiot. He's a rich idiot, doesn't understand free speech, doesn't understand state action, and didn't bother to educate himself about any of that before spending $44 billion. And when CNN asks who's going to be the first one off Twitter, I volunteer.
Never been on Twitter, so it doesn't matter.
Good.
I found it obnoxious wow. from the beginning. I found it obnoxious from the beginning,
yeah.
okay?
Yeah.
Okay? And this idea that people are judged by the number of followers they have, that somehow
mm-hmm.
they're an influencer, okay? And that always bothered me, too. That's one of the reasons why I'm not crazy about things like Instagram. I don't put anything up on Instagram. My daughter does sometimes, and other people that I know do. And so they say, I put something up on Instagram, because I don't go on Instagram and look. So they tell me, I got something on Instagram. Okay, well, I'll go take a look at it. But I have an account, but I don't use it. I have a Twitter account. I never really understood Twitter that much, and now I want to understand it even less. So,
mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people are going to drop off. Now, Trump sits there and says he's going to stay with truth. Okay? Again, the
right.
man doesn't know truth if he thought, so I don't know what truth he's talking about here. Okay, I think he named it that because it's like Jesus taught the truth. You ever hear that one? He spoke the
mm-hmm.
truth. Okay, I guess he sees himself as Jesus. I don't know. There's been a lot
His
of
followers
messiahs.
Do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of messiahs out there. Okay, there's one buried in Brooklyn, if I'm not incorrect. Okay, there are a lot of people who claim that they're messianic. Okay, well, if you read the Bible. None of them have delivered, ever. So he ain't been here yet. Well, that's the Jewish way of looking at it. I'm not putting down people who are Christian. I know they believe that. Okay, and then there's going to be a second coming, and everybody's going to be arisen. Okay, Jews believe in the resurrection too. Okay, but the bottom line is that at least as far as I see, nobody's delivered yet. Okay, when you deliver. I believe that you're the guy or the woman. But, but there's a messianic thought process here. Okay? A message that should be sent. And I don't know that Twitter is the way that – I don't want to find out that the resurrection is coming on Twitter. Okay, I don't want to get a message, you know, from God on Twitter saying, today's the day. Okay. Thank you. I'm going to work anyway. Just kind of the thought process. And I know people who are religious are going to think I'm being just so – it's heresy. I'm speaking heresy. But, I you know, again, I have a First Amendment right, right?
Oh,
there's
gosh.
Your First Amendment at work, people. Okay. Okay. Best way to put it. So, yeah. This guy's going to be a disaster. It's either going to be a disaster for us or a disaster for him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He has this feeling of infallibility. And he uses the public market. He takes his companies public for a reason, to raise money. And then when the company has enough money, then he uses the company to buy out the stock and goes private and owns it himself. That's what he does. That's what he did with Tesla. So I don't know what he's going to do with this third base. I really just don't know. So, okay, so we've killed Elon Musk for today. Okay, what else we got? We got all. Just go down the list. We made a list. Let's just, you know, keep going.
Yeah. Well, should we hit the Santas next? You got something you want to say about the Santas? I've got a take on him too.
Der Führer? Yeah, I want to talk about the Führer. The Führer of Florida. I'm going to press this point again. I'm going to try to press this point to my friend Charlie Crist. And I'm going to try to press it to the people of Florida and anybody else that will listen. Everything this guy has done for the last 6 months is the playbook for authoritarianism. Banning books. Going after boogeymen, whether it's the LGBTQ community or whether it is critical race theory, which, by the way, nobody teaches critical race theory. That was a book that was written by a college professor, and yes, it's probably taught in black studies and things like that, but nobody teaches critical race theory anywhere in primary and secondary education that I'm aware of, at least not in the public schools. Yesterday, he did it again. He created his own army. People that are going to enforce and be in charge of enforcing the election laws in the state of Florida. He's literally going to use an army to control the election process, to intimidate local election officials, with members of his army standing over their shoulders. And anytime they don't like what that person's doing or what that department is doing, they're going to step in and file charges or whatever it is they're authorized to do. Talking about fixing and rigging elections, excuse me, this is what authoritarians around the world do to get themselves reelected by overwhelming margins. Looking over the shoulders of voters, looking over the shoulders of elections officials, throwing away ballots, taking over voting machines, rigging the software, all being done by his army. He has decided we don't need a legislature. We need a legislature to make it look good because we have a constitution that says we have a legislature, but we don't really need a legislature. We just need Republicans controlling the legislature and doing what I tell you to do. And if you don't do what I tell you to do, here's what I'm going to tell you to do. By throwing out, one map was thrown out of you know, redistricting was thrown out by the courts. So the legislature redid it, and they didn't do it good enough for him. He openly says, I don't want districts that are controlled by black voters. I want districts that are controlled by Republicans. I want 20 of the 27 districts in the state of Florida to be controlled by Republicans. People, both the Republican and Democratic parties have approximately 37.5% of the registered voters in the state of Florida. The rest are independents. Please tell me why it is that 70% or more of each house of the legislature in the state of Florida is controlled by Republicans. Why 20 of 27 districts in the state of Florida are going to be controlled by Republicans if this map takes place? They have a little bit more registered Republicans than Democrats, but it's a 50-50 split, with 24% being independents. Please explain to me, like I'm a fifth grader, how that works out, that half the people in this state are completely and totally disenfranchised because the feels that's the way that it should be. Everything he does is a rehearsal for being president of the United States, especially if Republicans control both houses of Congress. That's what he wants. That's what he needs. Get rid of the filibuster completely. We're just going to pass things and pass things and pass things, and we're taking over, and we're going to make it harder for Democrats to ever have any control, ever, ever, ever. Even though a majority of the United, of the people in the United States continually vote for Democrats for president of the United States. This is the most dangerous man in the United States, bar none, and that includes Donald Trump, because Donald Trump is stupid. I used to call him moron DeSantis. He's not a moron. He's just out and out evil. And if this man becomes president of the United States, I said it last week, I'll say it again, pack your bags, get your money offshore before he can stop you, and get the hell out of here, which is what he really wants. Anybody that opposes him can leave, but leave your money behind. That's what they did in Germany. Remember, they said, you can leave if you want to, but everything you own stays. This is a bad man. This is an evil man. This is a megalomaniac that makes Donald look tame. And I'm betting dollars to donuts he is the Republican candidate for president of the United States. I've said before, I'm friends with Charlie Crist. I'm not saying these things because I'm friends with Charlie Crist, because I'm not real happy with him right now either. Charlie's a mild-mannered, soft-spoken man. He cannot be mild-mannered, and he can't be soft-spoken in this election. He's got to get angry. He's got to sound angry. He's got to attack this guy and everything that he does, every opportunity he has. He should be out there with press releases and giving press conferences and making statements left and right about how evil this guy is. But he's not. And the next time I see him, I'm going to tell him so. This is a bad guy. People, wake up. He's here. He's reincarnated. And he's as dangerous as anybody else. and more so than others. I haven't seen one good thing come out of this legislature. And now he's after Disney? Seriously? Hey, Disney, big corporation, you're not a person. Keep your mouth shut. Just keep writing checks to the Republican Party, or I'll punish you. Shut up. I want to see Disney take everything down like an Erector set and move it someplace else and build it someplace else and watch Orlando shrink in size, watch companies leave, watch restaurants go out of business, watch stores close, because nobody goes there to go to Universal. Nobody goes there to go to SeaWorld. Nobody goes there to go to the outlet malls. They go there to Disney, and then they go to the other places because you're there for a week. You can do other things. Ripley's, believe it or not, will be out of business in a heartbeat. And the people of the state of Florida are going to pick up a $2 billion bill for the bonds that were floated by Reedy Creek, and they're going to pick up $163 million in taxes that now are not going to be paid by Disney. Somebody didn't think this through, did they? That's why it's not effective until next July, because DeSantis says he'll get reelected and then Disney will fold and say they're sorry. I'd rather they said goodbye, and I'll pack them a lunch so they don't get hungry on the way out of town. This is bad stuff.
Yeah, when you look at the chain of events, the entire chain of events leading up to where we are now with DeSantis versus Disney, it all started with the Don't Say Gay bill. Right, so you talk about totalitarianism and authoritarianism and the playbook. One of the things in the playbook, of course, is to identify the outgroup, the other, and paint it as the enemy. Right, so so we have this bill that says, essentially you're not allowed to talk about sexual orientation in schools. As though that was some kind of a big problem here in the state of Florida. Issue at all. But you have to have that, right? So they created their boogeyman. Now, they went beyond that, and anybody who opposed that law, because the only effect that law is going to have is to stigmatize young people who are already struggling with these issues that young people struggle with. So that's the only thing you're going to do is hurt kids. And so there was opposition to it. Say, well, this seems kind of mean-spirited. Why are we doing this? Why are we sending this message to kids? And by the way, threatening teachers. So if you opposed the bill, they started calling you groomers. Okay, so now they're painting all liberals and all Democrats and all even moderates or independents who think that we shouldn't be mean to kids. You're a groomer. Which is flat out accusing people of being pedophiles.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because they oppose a bill that says you can't mention sexual orientation in a school.
And that's why our hero mm-hmm. has to be Molly. McCready, I think her name is, or whatever. The senator, the state senator in Michigan, in her speech.
Right. Right.
That's our hero.
That's right. Yes. Right. That's but it's an amazing authoritarian move, right? To start calling people groomers, to associate gay people with pedophilia, to make them out, and I've talked about this on the show before, right? To make them out as a dangerous problem that needs to be solved.
Mm-hmm.
Where have we heard that before?
Yeah, the final solution.
Mm-hmm. Right? I've said this before. It's one thing to say these people are inferior. It's another thing to say they're strange. But it's a completely different type of bigotry to say they're a problem that needs to be solved. Now we're in genocide territory.
Right.
Right. They're dangerous.
I agree. I 100% agree. Find a boogeyman. Yeah. Tell them they're to blame for your lot in life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, not
mm-hmm.
us, not you, but them. They're
not
the
only,
reason
not
why
only...
they're the reason why you can't afford 2 6-packs, only one.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And they've gone a step further than they're coming for you and they're coming for your money. They thought
and
this
your job.
No, how about your kids?
Yeah,
they're coming
for
your
kids.
Okay, you want to get people really worked up? Tell them that these people, this dangerous problem is coming for your kids. It's right out of the playbook. Okay, so then Disney
right.
says, we don't like that law, a private company, and then he punishes Disney for what they say,
right.
for expressing themselves. You're not allowed to
but
do that in the state of Florida.
But he defends their First Amendment right to contribute to campaigns as free speech.
Sure, right, right.
In other words, write the checks and shut your mouth. Disney made Florida. Without Disney, the state of Florida would not be what it is. It wouldn't be. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. It'd still be the place where the old Jewish people go on Miami Beach for Passover and sit out on the porch in their rocking chairs. And Lincoln Road would still be filled with nothing but schlockatorians. And Miami would still be just a sleepy little town. That's the truth. Disney made Florida. But they're not allowed to speak.
No.
Okay.
Not
I'd
Florida.
Like to raise, yeah, I'd like, we got about a minute or two left.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to talk about our favorite congresswoman from Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Who we had a governor down here is now a senator who took the Fifth Amendment 75 times in a deposition involving a civil deposition involving his health care company. You know him, Voldemort, you know, Rick Scott.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have a congresswoman who decided I'm not going to take the Fifth Amendment privilege because Fifth Amendment rights, because that's like admission. I'm just going to say, I don't remember. I don't remember. When confronted, I still don't remember. And she was not confronted with the really bad stuff. Like 2 days after the insurrection, writing a text to Mark Meadows saying, we should invoke martial law. She misspelled martial, by the way.
Yeah, of course she did. Right.
M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L is not martial law, you moron. Okay,
yeah,
and
she
it's
thought
not
it was a department store. Right.
Yeah, it's or it was, you know, maybe she obviously wasn't talking about the former justice of the United States Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
but Thurgood. But the fact of the matter is that it's small M A R T I A L. Okay, got it, moron. Okay, but forgetting the fact that she doesn't understand the English language and know what she's talking about most of the time, we have to invoke martial law. And not allow Biden to be, you know, have his inauguration. I don't remember. How many people would write a seditious text message like that and not remember? Seriously, you don't remember? Do you remember who you are when you wake up in the morning? Or do you have it written on the wall in the mirror that says, you are Marjorie Taylor Greene? Okay, like the movie, 51st Dates. Watch the tape, okay? This is you. I mean, I'm sorry. I used to be a judge. All of you know that. Somebody says I don't remember 50 times for something that clearly anybody who has any kind of memory that doesn't have brain damage, and if she has brain damage, she shouldn't be on the Congress anyway, but who has brain damage would remember, like advocating the overthrow of the United States government by force. I'm sorry. You say that once or twice I can understand. Maybe you don't remember a specific tweet, you don't remember a specific text, but give me a break. You don't remember sending a text to Mark Meadows that says that. Really? I'm sorry. I'm the judge in this case. You keep saying, I don't remember. Those are three words. I got four words for you. I don't believe you. It only takes one word to call you a liar. I don't believe you. One more word than you say. I don't. You say, I don't remember. I say, I don't believe you. And since you can't contradict the testimony that's been given, you lose. Preponderance of the evidence met. You're not qualified. You're an insurrectionist or a seditionist at worst or at best. Am I missing something here?
No. Nope. No. Nope. I don't believe so. That's I suppose that's a good note to end on.
You're not adding anything. Okay.
No.
Okay. Glasses full.
Why would I? You said it well enough. I have a policy. If somebody else says what I think, I just don't say anything.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you could say I agree with you. But instead, you got anything to say? Nope, got nothing to say. Okay.
No, got nothing. I got nothing on that.
Okay. Oh, okay. We'll buy that.
It's Hezzy's air, man.
Okay. It's Hezzy's air. It is Hezzy's air.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm here.
Yeah, I know.
No problem.
We're saying it's your air, man. And we thank you for it. Every single week we thank you for it. Believe me. We really do. So
yeah,
always a pleasure, Calvin.
Okay.
Really.
No, it's really ours.
Enjoy the week. We'll wait
till
next week. There's more coming.
Yeah. There are always.
We didn't even get to Secretary Austin and his blooper, but we'll talk about that next week.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Hezzy, have a wonderful week.
You
and,
too.
And
all the best,
Brendan. I'll talk to you
thank
soon.
Thank you very,
okay,
very
take
much.
Care.
All right. Sounds good. Yeah.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye, everybody.
Be good.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
How exciting! You know, you got to wait for next Tuesday. Because there's not enough this Tuesday. There'll be always next Tuesday. What a pleasure. All right, well, let's go in and cover some other things that are around the corner. And there's a lot of international news, that's for sure. So let's look at some of the things that are really a little bit frightening. One of the most compelling is probably the nuclear threat should not be underestimated, Russia warns. Can you imagine? The United States has been rushing more weaponry to Ukraine and said that the assistance from Western allies is making a difference in the two-month-old war. Well, Russia's top diplomat warned that Ukraine against provoking World War III and said that the threat of a nuclear conflict, quote, should not be underestimated, end quote, as his country unleashed attacks against rail and fuel installations far from the front lines of Moscow's new eastern offensive. Meanwhile, the British Defense Ministry said on Tuesday that Russian forces had taken the Ukrainian city of Kremina in the Luhansk region after days of street-to-street fighting. Well, the city of Kremina has reportedly fallen, and heavy fighting is reported south of Izium as Russian forces attempt to advance towards the city of Lovyansk and Kramatorsk from the north and east. The British military said in a tweet, it did not say how it knew the city about 355 miles southeast of the Ukrainian city of Kyiv had fallen. The Ukrainian government did not immediately comment. Well, Ukraine's general staff said Russian forces were shelling Kharkiv, the country's second largest city, as they fought to take the full control of the Donetsk and Luhansk regions, which comprise the Donbas in Ukraine's industrial heartland, and establish a land corridor to Crimea. In the area of Velika Oleksandrivka, a village in the Kherson region largely controlled by Russians, Ukrainian forces destroyed an ammunition depot and eliminated, quote-unquote, more than 70 Russian troops, the general staff had said. Well, the governor of the Luhansk region, Serhiy Hadai, said on the messaging app Telegram that the Russians had shelled civilians 17 times over the previous 24 hours with the cities of Popasna, Lichansk, and Kursky surviving and so actually suffering the most. Four people died and nine more were wounded on Monday in the Russian shelling of the Donetsk region, its governor Pavlo Kirilenko said on Telegram. He said a nine-year-old girl and a 14-year-old boy were among those killed. Well, the U.S. has been rushing more weaponry to Ukraine and said the assistance from Western allies is making a difference in the two-month-old war. Russia is failing. Ukraine is succeeding, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken declared on Monday after he and the United States Secretary of Defense made a bold visit to Kyiv to meet with President Volodymyr Zelensky. Blinken said that Washington approved a $165 million sale of ammunition, non-U.S. ammo, mainly, if not entirely, for Ukraine's Soviet-era weapons, and will also provide more than $300 million in financing to buy more supplies. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin went further, saying that the U.S. wants to see Ukraine remain a sovereign, democratic country, but also wants, quote, to see Russia weaken to the point where it can't do things like invade Ukraine, end quote. Austin's remarks appeared to represent a shift in U.S. strategic goals, since earlier Washington said the goal of American military aid was to help Ukraine win and to defend Ukraine's NATO neighbors against Russian threats. In an apparent response to Austin, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Russia was, quote, has a feeling that the West wants Ukraine to continue to fight and, as it seems to them, wear out, exhaust the Russian army and the Russian military-industrial war complex. This is an illusion, he said. Weapons supplied by Western countries, quote, will be a legitimate target, end quote, said Lavrov, who accused Ukrainian leaders of provoking Russia by asking NATO to become involved in the conflict. NATO forces are pouring oil on the fire, Lavrov said, according to a transcript on the Russian Foreign Ministry's website. Everyone is reciting incantations that in no case can we allow World War III, he said in a Russian television interview. Lavrov said he would not want to see risks of a nuclear confrontation, quote, artificially inflated now, when the risks are rather significant, end quote. The danger is serious, he said. It is real. It should not be underestimated. It's bad, very bad, hopeless, he says. Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba said on Twitter that Lavrov's comments underscore Ukraine's need for Western help. Quote, Russia loses a last hope to scare the world off supporting Ukraine. Thus, the talk of a real danger of World War III, the only means Moscow senses defeat in Ukraine. When Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24, its apparent goal was to seize Kyiv, capital, but the Ukrainians, helped by Western weapons, forced President Vladimir Putin's troops to retreat. Moscow now says its goal is to take the Donbass, the mostly Russian-speaking industrial region in eastern Ukraine, where residents are struggling to survive without many of the basics, collecting rainwater for cleaning and washing up, and fervently hoping for an end of the fighting. When you open a plastic bottle and it makes a crackling sound, you are worried at once, thinking that it's an explosion because of all those blasts. Anything that is happening, any noise, if our neighbors bang the door, a metal door, you are startled, said Andriy Chermomushkin, a resident of Toretsk, a small city south of Kramatorsk. it's bad, very bad, hopeless, he said. You feel so hopeless that you don't know what you should do or shouldn't do, because if you want to do something, you need some money, and there is no money now. Ukrainian troops are tying down Russian forces. On Monday, Russia was focusing its firepower beyond the Donbas with missiles and warplanes striking far behind the front lines to try to thwart Ukrainian supply efforts. Five railroad stations in central and western Ukraine were hit, and one worker was killed, said Oleksandr Kamishin, the head of Ukraine's state railway. Missiles struck Lviv, the western city near the Polish border, jammed by Ukrainians fleeing their home. Ukrainian authorities said at least five people were killed by Russian strikes in the central Vinnytsia region. Russia also declared an oil refinery and fuel depots in Kremenchuk in central Ukraine. Russian Defense Ministry spokesman Major General Igor Konashenkov said, in all, Russian warplanes destroyed 56 Ukrainian targets, he said. The strike on fuel depots are meant to deplete vital Ukrainian war resources. Strikes against rail targets both disrupt supply lines and intimidate people trying to use the railways to flee the fighting, said Philip Breedlove, a retired U.S. general who was NATO's top commander from 2013 to 2016. An estimated 2,000 Ukrainian troops holed up in a steel plant in the strategic southern port city of Mariupol are tying down Russian forces, apparently preventing them from joining the offensive elsewhere in the Donbas. Over the weekend, Russian forces launched new airstrikes on the Azovstal plant to try to dislodge the holdouts. Some 1,000 civilians were also said to be taking shelter at the steelworks. Well, the city council and mayor of Mariupol said a new mass grave was identified about 6 miles north of the city. Mayor Vadim Boychenko said that authorities were trying to estimate the number of victims. It was at least the third new mass grave discovered by Russian-controlled area near Mariupol in the last week. Mariupol has been gutted by bombardment and fierce street fighting over the past 2 months. Russia's capture of the city would deprive Ukraine of a vital port and give Moscow a land corridor to the Crimean Peninsula, which it seized from Ukraine in 2014. In his nightly video address, Zelensky said that Ukraine was maintaining its resistance to, quote, make the occupiers stay in our land even more intolerable while Russia drains its resources. Britain said it believes 15,000 Russian troops had been killed in Ukraine since Russia's invasion began. Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said 25% of the Russian combat units sent to Ukraine have been rendered not combat effective. Well, Ukrainian officials have said about 2,500 to 3,000 Ukrainian troops have been killed as of mid-April. So that's what's going on. Very frightening circumstance, to say the least. Now, let's look at some other things that you may find very important. It seems that the United Nations chief is calling for a ceasefire in his visit to Moscow. The United Nations chief is speaking in Moscow following talks with Russian officials. Meanwhile, the U.S., is hosting allies at Ramstein Air Base to discuss Ukraine security. Well, it seems that the U.S. hosts defense talks on arming Ukraine. Germany is going to supply Ukraine with anti-aircraft tanks. And UN head Guterres urges for a ceasefire in Moscow in his visit to Moscow. Russia's Lavrov says that NATO, in essence, engaged in a proxy war with Russia. And Zelensky says that Russia won't win the war in Ukraine. Well, Ukraine is concerned by destabilization in the Transdniester area. Ukraine says it is concerned by attempts to worsen the security situation in Moldova's pro-Russian breakaway province of Transnistria. Mykhailo Podolyak, a Ukrainian presidential aide, said in a post on Twitter, quote, Russia wants to destabilize the Transnistrian region and hint Moldova should wait for guests, end quote, wrote on, as it was written on Twitter. Bad news, if Ukraine falls tomorrow, Russian troops will be at Chisinau's gate, Podolyak had said, referring to Moldova's capital. Good news, Ukraine will definitely ensure a strategic security of the region, but we need to work as a team, Podolyak had added. It comes after several apparent attacks in the region. In the past day, attacks have reportedly targeted a military unit, the state security headquarters, and an old Soviet-era radio antenna. The head of the breakaway province, also known as Transnistria or Transdniestria in English, claimed that the apparent attacks could be traced back to Ukraine. Quote, I assume that those who organized this attack have the purpose of dragging Transnistria into the conflict, self-styled President Vadim Krasnodelsky was quoted as saying by Russian news agency TASS. His office has established, quote, a red, end quote, level of terrorist threat for the next 15 days and canceled public Victory Day event on May 9. Citing safety concerns. Moscow, which deploys troops in the region, also voiced serious concern and blamed Ukraine. Moldovan President Maia Sandu has urged citizens to remain calm, saying she had stepped up security measures and convened the country's Supreme Security Council. She condemned the apparent attacks, in which no one was injured. She blamed the attack on, quote, internal differences between various groups in Transnistria that have an interest in destabilizing the situation, end quote. Last week, a senior Russian military officer said Russia aims to take control of Ukraine's south and open a land corridor to the region. Security and defense journalist Thomas Vigold has told Deutsche Welle the Gepard vehicles that Berlin has approved for delivery could make a real difference in Ukraine's in terms of anti-aircraft capability. Although they are known as tanks, Vigold said the Gepard, also known as Cheetah, vehicles are more of an anti-aircraft cannon mounted on an armored chassis. They can make quite a difference. The German army has taken them out of use almost a decade ago, not because they were obsolete, but because at that time the Bundeswehr was scaling down and they had no use for it anymore. I think they regretted it. Meanwhile, short-range air defense is such in demand everywhere now, and especially in Ukraine, so the Ukrainians can make use of it, of course. Vigold said that technically the German government was only approving the German industry selling equipment to Ukraine rather than sending it directly. He said that although an apparent U-turn, the decision, quote, allows the government to convey the idea it's not that new because it's not German military stock, end quote. Riegel said that much of the valuable heavy weaponry was coming from former Warsaw Pact countries that, like Ukraine, relied on Soviet-era equipment. However, he said that further down the line, the West would have to start sharing newer equipment and train Ukrainians in how to use it. If the West wants to continue supporting Ukraine, they have to think about starting training Ukrainians on Western systems to deliver Western systems as well. Erdogan and Putin are discussing peace talks protecting civilians. Well, the Kremlin says that Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin have discussed Moscow's efforts to ensure the safety of civilians in Ukraine. The Kremlin said in a statement that the two leaders spoke about efforts made by Russia on a constant basis to ensure the safety of peaceful civilians, including the organization of humanitarian corridors. In response to Erdogan's questions on the besieged southeastern port city of Mariupol, Putin said, quote, the city is liberated and combat operations are not going on there, end quote, according to the Russian statement. Hundreds of civilians are still sheltering in the city's huge Azovstal industrial area while Ukrainian troops are still resisting Russia. Putin told Erdogan that Kyiv should, quote, take political responsibility and for humanitarian reasons ordered them, the troops, to lay down arms, the Kremlin had said. They also discussed the safety of Turkish ships sailing from Black Sea ports through a cooperation of defense ministries. The Turkish side released a statement saying that Erdogan urged Putin to agree to direct talks with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Erdogan proposed taking the Istanbul process to the level of leaders, a crucial threshold in the Russia-Ukraine negotiations, according to the statement. Talks have so far stalled over accusations of Russian war crimes, and Putin later said peace efforts were at a dead end. Poland is going to sanction 50 Russian entities and people. Poland has announced it will impose sanctions on 50 Russian entities and individuals. The sanctions came in addition to current European measures, according to Polish Interior Minister Mariusz Kamiński. The list includes gas giant Gazprom and Moshe Kantor, who owns part of Poland's state-owned chemical group, Azoty. Anyway, companies on the list will have their assets frozen and be excluded from public tenders, while Russian oligarchs on the list will be banned from entering Poland. The UN is ready to save lives in Mariupol, the United Nations Chief UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres had said during a meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov that the organization is ready to fully mobilize its resources to save lives in Mariupol. Quote, the United Nations is ready to fully mobilize its human and logistical resources to help save lives in Mariupol, Guterres had said. Guterres also proposed coordinated work with the Red Cross to allow people to evacuate from the Azovstal steel plant in the city. Civilians and Ukrainian troops have been holed up in the plant for weeks. Thousands of civilians are in dire need of life-saving humanitarian assistance, and many have evacuated, Guterres had said. Guterres said that he was concerned about possible war crimes in Ukraine, adding that they require independent investigation. The United Nations chief meets Putin in Moscow. Well, the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres is holding a joint press conference with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov following talks about the war in Moscow. He had also been due to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin. This is the first in-person visit from Guterres since the start of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. During an earlier meeting with Lavrov, Guterres called for a ceasefire to be implemented as soon as possible, quote unquote. Russia has also expelled three Swedish diplomats. Russia said it was expelling three Swedish diplomats in a retaliatory move against Stockholm. In early April, Sweden said it was expelling three Russian diplomats who accused it of conducting illegal operations there. Russia's foreign ministry said it summoned the Swedish ambassador to Russia and strongly protested, quote unquote, the expulsion of Russian diplomats in Sweden's military support to the Kiev regime. Well, the ministry accused Sweden of covering up the crimes of the Ukrainian nationalists against the civilian population of Donbas in Ukraine. In response to this, the Russian side decided to declare persona non grata three diplomats of the Swedish embassy in Russia, the ministry said. And the ceasefire needed is as soon as possible, so said the United Nations Guterres. So we'll see where that goes. Ukrainian troops are going to train on German soil, the defense minister said. German defense minister Christine Lambrecht said that Ukrainian troops will be trained on German soil. The remarks stem from a statement she gave at the Ramstein U.S. Air Base in Germany during a U.S.-hosted defense conference. And we are working together with our American friends to train Ukrainian troops on artillery systems on German soil. Along with the Netherlands, provide self-propelled howitzer and ammunition training to Ukraine, as we all know that artillery is an essential factor in this conflict. Lambrecht addressed criticism leveled at Germany for not delivering heavier weaponry to Ukraine and pointed to the government's decision to provide anti-aircraft tanks as progress. So there's a lot going on here, and we'll have to see where that goes. Evidently, the United Nations expects 8.3 million people to flee Ukraine this year. That's what the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, said on Tuesday. UNHCR had previously planned for some 4 million refugees in the immediate aftermath of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Now they've doubled it to 8.3. More than 12.7 million people have fled their homes in Ukraine in the last 2 months. Person from UNHCR is Shabia Mantu, and so that's what she said. So we'll have to see where else things go. There are other concerns. This is also something a little bit different but important to be noted. It seems that women are less likely to recover from long COVID. That's what a United Kingdom study said. It seems that more than two-thirds of people hospitalized with COVID-19 still suffer symptoms a year later, United Nations researchers have said, and women and obese people are more at risk of long COVID. Well, negative health impacts from severe cases of COVID-19 continue to affect many people even a year after contracting the disease, making it urgent to develop treatments. A UK study released on Sunday had shown without effective treatments, long COVID could become a highly prevalent new long-term condition, said Christopher Breitling of the University of Leicester, who co-led the study published in the Lancet Respiratory Medical Journal. And what did the study find? The study involving altogether more than 2,300 people showed just 26% of those who had been hospitalized with COVID-19 reporting a full recovery after 5 months and only 28.9% after a full year. Women were 33% less likely than men to make a full recovery, according to the study. Those who required mechanical ventilation while in hospital and obese people were even more at risk. The most common symptoms reported by the long COVID sufferers were breathlessness, fatigue, muscle pain, sleep problems, limb weakness, and mental health impairment. Breitling said there was, quote, an urgent need for health care services to support this large and rapidly increasing patient population, end quote. Even a year after leaving hospital, many people who are suffering from long COVID show serious symptoms, including reduced exercise capacity and large decrements in health-related quality of life, the authors wrote. So these are really, really big problems. Now, there are other issues as well we want to cover, so bear with me a moment. There's just so much today. Let's look at what else is happening. The war in Ukraine is driving hunger in Lebanon. It seems after years of political and financial crises, Lebanese people are now also in danger of going hungry. Germany has promised more food aid as imports from Ukraine and Russia dwindle. Normally, breaking fast is a joyful celebration during the holy month of Ramadan. But the women of the Matbach El Kur community kitchen in Beirut, Lebanon, are cooking with local supplies just to prevent starvation. Hundreds of food packages stand ready for delivery, destined for people who would not be able to break fast without this help. On her trip to the Lebanese capital, German Development Minister Svenja Schulze visited the kitchen, praising the project as a prime example of sustainable aid done right. Using regional foods, local women are being given jobs and are able to feed their families. At the same time, the kitchen's output is helping people in dire need. Matbach El Kur is located in a neighborhood that was severely damaged by the Beirut port blast in August 2020. What were once homes are now concrete ruins. Panes are missing. Entire walls and facades have crumbled. The roof of the former gas station lies on the ground as if it folded up, and the gas pumps are rusted over. We see that normal people can no longer afford their daily food, the minister said, promising another $10.6 million in aid to the World Food Program in Lebanon. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has also exacerbated the food crisis in Lebanon. Putin is also waging a war of hunger, Schulz had said. Food prices are rising because Ukraine is now unable to make deliveries. Lebanon is in a dangerous state of dependency. Nearly all of its grain is imported. According to UNICEF, 80% of the wheat in Lebanon comes from Russia and Ukraine. Compounding this issue are skyrocketing food prices around the world and a lack of storage space for grain due to the destroyed silos in the port. The ruins of the grain silos still stand at the port, a symbol of the desperate situation across the entire country. Quote, in less than 2 years, there have been four successive major crises, said Sami Nader, the director of the Levant Institute for Strategic Affairs, LISA, LISA, and they have combined to create an aggravated crisis that Lebanon is now suffering. The economic and financial crisis in 2019, the COVID pandemic, the explosion in the port of Beirut, and finally the war in Ukraine. According to Schulz, Lebanon needs long-term solutions as well as short-term aid to avoid further humanitarian crises. The Lebanese government must help to ensure that more food is cultivated right here so that the Lebanese population is able to provide for itself, she said. The minister hopes the new government will address the issue. Lebanon's election is 3 weeks away, but the outlook is bleak amidst chronic political instability. This is not a stable situation, Schulz said. It's not easy to advance political reforms here either, but that has to change. We can't help here permanently. There must be a commitment from the government. Lebanon was once called the Switzerland of the Middle East because of its wealth. Now 80% of the population live below the poverty line. The purchasing power of the Lebanese is dwindling by the day. On top of that, the Lebanese pound has lost 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar, economist Sami Nader said. But that makes the situation worse is that there is no sunlight on the horizon. There is no clear solution. The country is now hoping for a rescue loan from the International Monetary Fund, and Lebanon is to receive $3 billion on the condition that the Lebanese government implements far-reaching reforms. Nader, however, remains pessimistic. This is just ink on paper. The government has submitted a draft plan for financial reconstruction to the IMF to start financing, but is the government capable of implementing this plan? And the answer is no, he said. Aid organizations will also call for the government to step up. Quote, for us as a World Food Program, it is extremely important that solutions are negotiated that are supported and driven by political will, said Uta Klamert, the assistant executive director of the World WFP, I'm losing my mind. The World Food Program. Otherwise, we will keep moving from emergency to emergency. But the Lebanese, who have suffered from widespread corruption for years, do not trust the government. Too often in the past, they have seen aid money end up in the wrong hands. To ensure that the aid money does not disappear, the WFP has set up a new program in Lebanon. It distributes cards that function like electronic food vouchers. With these, those affected can buy food in more than 400 grocery stores. It's a model that can serve as an example to others. 100% of the money in food is meant to get to where it's needed most. Meanwhile, 23-year-old Lynn continued to pack food in Matbach El-Kel in Beirut. Coleslaw, a rice dish, and some fruit, what she earns here also helps her parents and brother, she said. She has just finished school and dreams of one day studying at a university, but a lot has to change for that to happen in Lebanon and other parts of the world. Oh, my goodness. Now, let me just quickly look. Bear with me a second. All right. We have a little bit more time, which is great. Now let's look at the problems of Ukraine and how it affects other places. The Estonian Prime Minister, her name is Kaja Kallas, says that our neighbors' problems today are our problems tomorrow. Fearing that they might be the next targets of Russia's aggression, the leaders of some Eastern NATO countries or members would like Germany to do more to stop the invasion of Ukraine. Estonian Prime Minister Kaja Kallas discussed the issue with Deutsche Welle's Michaela Küssner. One second. This is a video. Bear with me a second. Bear with me a second. Okay. We'll see. Hopefully this will come through.
Prime Minister Kallas, you say you're expecting strong leadership from Germany right now. What exactly do you mean?
What we definitely expect is that Germany is also supporting all the decisions that we make together and also showing the leadership. In democracy, of course, you know, gas or oil could be expensive, but freedom is really priceless. So if you take the leadership role and also explain what is at stake here, our neighbors' problems today are our problems tomorrow. If we help to end this war, there will be less war refugees for Germany. There will be less problems regarding the economy as well. And therefore, the strong sanctions hitting hard would be something that would maybe end this war, not immediately, but still. So this is one side, and the other side where we expect Germany's leadership is in NATO. I've very carefully followed the discussions that you have in Germany, and I understand what is the starting point here. But if you say that we don't want to go to any other war that is going on somewhere else, I totally understand that. But if NATO is a defensive alliance, we are in this together. Also, Germany has said Article 5 is ironclad, and Germany will come to help if necessary. But then it's also for everybody important, including Germany, to make those decisions so that we make NATO stronger and there will be no need to come to any help at all.
So what do you feel isn't understood in Berlin yet that is understood in the Baltic countries, for instance?
That our neighbors' problems today are our problems tomorrow. If we don't help our neighbors when their house is on fire, the fire will also catch your house.
Prime Minister Kallas, thank you very much.
Well, okay, and let's look at what's happening in Finland. Bear with me a moment as we move there. Finland is looking to join NATO as Russia's war rages. The war in Ukraine gives Finland a reason to move closer to applying for NATO membership, and the country is rethinking its long-held neutral status amid concerns about a new Iron Curtain falling along Russia's borders. So listen to this. Bear with me a moment.
It saved my $40,000.
One split second.
And I'm from being sold.
Okay.
Out from under my eye. We have this bad boy mounted on the shed that overlooks for my Can-Am shed. And would you believe that there was somebody outside trying to hook up with their truck to my trailer?
One split second. So this is like a commercial, which we're going to wait and go. All right, now we should be able to hear the report from Deutsche Welle. Bear with me a second.
Russia's war on Ukraine has finally made Finland feel it's time to take sides. If there's a new Iron Curtain coming into the Europe, then Finns hope to be on the western side of that curtain. In the best-case scenario,
One second. For some reason,
would be Finland's 1,300-kilometer border with Russia. Worst-case scenario, Finland, which, like Ukraine, is outside of NATO, becomes a Kremlin target. Until the February invasion, Finns preferred this non-aligned status, having built their own powerful military with one of the largest weapons stockpiles in Western Europe and a high proportion of citizens willing and trained to fight if necessary.
We have very top defense forces here, and we have very big reservist organization here, almost 900,000.
But now a decision on whether those assets could become NATO's northeastern flank is expected within weeks, widely predicted to be positive after a spike in public support following Moscow's attack. The Finnish parliament is debating the question of membership as the government seeks consensus before making its decision. The prime minister herself has reversed course from saying in January that alliance membership was not even on the table.
Our process will be quite fast. It will happen in weeks.
But the very process of seeking the security guarantees provided by the alliance has its own risks. Moscow repeatedly threatens serious political and military consequences should Finland proceed on the path towards NATO membership. And such retaliation could come while Finland waits for the 30 allied governments to accept and ratify its membership.
We are probably going to be very, very well prepared for different potential hybrid warfare. We're talking about refugee flows over the Finnish-Russian border, perhaps cyber attacks, the economic sanctions. The toolkit for hybrid measures is very wide, unfortunately.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has sought to reassure Helsinki.
They can easily join this alliance if they decide to apply. I'm certain that we'll find ways to address concerns they may have regarding the period between the potential application and the final ratification.
They means Finland and Sweden, as Stockholm is also reconsidering its historic opposition to joining the alliance and what it would mean to be the only non-NATO Nordic country if the Finns forge ahead.
So that's the story there. Bear with me a moment as we move on. We just have about 15 minutes left. And one second. All right. I think we have this done. I want to go over to another page. Bear with me a second here. Okay. All right. Hopefully this will go through. One moment here. Where is it? This is very interesting. Didn't expect this. Evidently, Beijing is beginning a mass COVID testing of nearly all 21 million residents. As feared grew that the Chinese capital may be placed under a strict lockdown like Shanghai. So China is trying to contain a wave of infections in Shanghai, its biggest city, which has been almost entirely locked down for weeks and reported 52 new COVID deaths yesterday. And Beijing authorities have ordered people in 12 central districts that account for most of its population to undergo three rounds of PCR testing after the detection of dozens of cases in the city in recent days. So we're going to have to see where all that goes. Very frightening circumstance, and it's a lot of fear. So those are some of the things that are happening. Also, on North Korea, Kim is vowing to strengthen his nuclear arsenal at a military parade. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un vowed to strengthen the country's nuclear weapons program during a speech at a high-profile military parade in Pyongyang, the state media reported today. We will continue to take steps to strengthen and develop our nation's nuclear capabilities at the fastest pace, Kim said, according to a transcript published by the official Korean Central News Agency. So according to the Korean Central News Agency, Kim gave a speech late Monday at a parade marking the 90th anniversary of the founding of the Korean People's Revolutionary Army at Kim II Sung Square in Pyongyang. North Korea is under biting international sanctions over its nuclear weapons program, and repeated negotiations aimed at convincing Kim to end it have come to nothing. Kim on Monday said that the country's nuclear weapons were a, quote, a symbol of national power, end quote, and that the country would, quote, further strengthen and develop our nuclear force at the highest possible speed. And Pyongyang has carried out more than a dozen weapon tests this year, including firing an intercontinental ballistic missile at full range for the first time since 2017. Well, U.S. and South Korean officials and analysts have warned Pyongyang could soon resume nuclear weapons testing for the first time since 2017. So I guess it's a stalemate. They're going to do what they want to do, and evidently nothing that the rest of the world can do to dissuade them. And I guess that's a problem. So we're going to have to see. One moment. This is really important. Evidently, the war in Ukraine is threatening the geopolitical balance in the Arctic. Russia shares a maritime border in the Arctic with European and American members of NATO, while environmental concerns and economic interests have typically dominated collaboration in the region. The war in Ukraine threatens to upset this careful balance. Russia's senior diplomat at the Arctic Council Intergovernmental Forum, Nikolai Korchinov, spoke out on April 17th about NATO's increased presence in the Arctic since the war in Ukraine began. He said long-planned military drills between NATO, Finland, and Sweden in the region in March were a cause for concern for Russia. The alliance recently held another large-scale military exercise in northern Norway. In our view, this does not contribute to the security of the region, he said. If the Western military alliance continues its Arctic activities, unintended incidents might occur, he said, without specifying what that might be. In such a unique part of the world, incidents of any kind could disrupt a fragile balance. The Arctic is a potential gold mine for energy resources and shipping routes, often governed by complex bilateral agreements between Arctic states. The eight Arctic countries, Canada, Finland, Denmark, the United States, Iceland, Norway, Sweden, and Russia, typically collaborate. United by their shared Arctic coastline, harsh environmental conditions have led them to forge agreements on maritime law, environmental balance, and security needs as basic as conducting effective search and rescue operations. The relationship in the Arctic are not ones that can be broken apart quickly, easily, or lightly, nor should they be, said Dr. Melanie Garson, the lecturer in International Conflict Resolution and Security in the Political Science Department of University of College London. There are critical issues in the Arctic that need to be kept stable for short-term and long-term stability. But there are signs that Russia's invasion of Ukraine is already disrupting this careful balance. Russia now shares the Arctic coastline with five NATO member states, plus Finland and Sweden, all of whom are sending military and financial support to help Ukraine fight against the Russian invasion. All the members of the Arctic Council, aside from Russia, announced in March they would boycott talks in Russia currently chairing the Atlantic Council until 2023 due to its flagrant violations of Ukraine's sovereignty. As such, the group's work has been put on hold. It's very unusual, Garson had said. The Arctic Council has survived periods of tension, but what we're seeing in the Ukraine is a huge turning point in history. We can't dismiss how that might affect tried and tested alliances. Political and economic concerns in the Arctic are defined by its unique and rapidly changing climate. While the South Arctic is covered in forest, further north the land becomes treeless, dominated by tundra, desert, and ice that is rapidly melting due to climate change. Past 30 years, the thickest ice in the Arctic has declined by 95%. If greenhouse gas emissions continue to increase at their current rate, the Arctic could be ice-free in the summer by 2040. My goodness, increased human presence poses an additional threat to a natural landscape that is already under pressure. Traditionally, the urgent climate situation has been a key reason for international cooperation. The first step towards the formation of the Arctic Council was the Arctic Environmental Protection Strategy, signed in 1991 as an agreement between the Arctic states and indigenous peoples' organizations. But the dramatic loss of ice is changing the political and economic landscape in the region. We are basically a fifth ocean opening on the top of the world, said Katarzyna Zisk, a professor of at the Norwegian Institute for Defense Studies. And when the ocean is open, it will be used for economic and military purposes. In Russia, loss of ice is also changing the military focus. Of the total Arctic Ocean coastline, 53% is Russian. It is a huge, vast area, Zisk says. Those borders were protected by ice, but now the ice is disappearing, and that means the region can be used potentially in an attack on Russia. Consequently, Russia has been increasing its military presence in the far north. The most obvious example of this is its Arctic Navy, the Northern Fleet, based on the Kola Peninsula near the border with Finland and Norway. Its arsenal includes submarines armed with nuclear-powered missiles and anti-submarine aircraft, aircraft carriers and ships armed with missiles, among others. The Northern Fleet is the strongest part of the Russian Navy, Zisk had said. Russia has their largest share of strategic submarines and other important non-nuclear capabilities on the Kola Peninsula. And Ukraine was a game changer. In 2014, the same year that Russia annexed the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine, the Northern Fleet became the main component in a strengthened military presence in the north called the Northern Fleet Joint Strategic Command. And to international observers, Russia's military activities in the Arctic took on an increasingly aggressive stance, raising the stakes for other Arctic states. The major thrust of NATO's interest in the Arctic came after the annexation of Crimea, Zisk had said. Ukraine was a game changer because even though Russia had been generally cooperative and predictable in the Arctic, NATO could not detach what Russia was doing in Ukraine from its military expansion in the Arctic. This meant also increasing NATO's presence in the Arctic to ensure that if Article 5 were triggered by a Russian attack in the region, the group could provide a required collective defense. However, Russia also continued increasing its forces. From 2016 onward, it upped the frequency of its military exercises in the Arctic, even displaying, quote, an ability to project power beyond its Arctic waters and assert maritime control, end quote, according to the nonprofit policy research organization known as the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The current war in Ukraine has raised the stakes once again. If Sweden and Finland join NATO, as both are seriously considering doing, all the Arctic states except Russia will be part of the military alliance. NATO will then have a strategic reevaluation of how the Arctic sits within the alliance, and decisions NATO will take will set the future relationship, Garson had said. And given the rumblings from Russia about this potential NATO expansion, that could cause tension. Most recently, these rumblings include an April 14th threat that if Sweden and Finland join NATO, then Russia would deploy nuclear weapons and hypersonic missiles to the Baltic region. There are some scenarios you could imagine where Russia could challenge Article 5, Zisk had said. One possibility is that Russia could do it in the Arctic because it has a relatively strong military presence there compared to the other NATO states. However, Russia is not necessarily building up its military force in the Arctic for an attack. It has plenty there to protect, too. The 2008 study by the U.S. Geological Survey found that the Arctic could be home to the largest unexplored oil and gas reserves on Earth, storing billions of barrels of unmined energy resources. Much of the reserves are thought to be offshore in Russian seas. Now, oil and gas are not the only potential asset. The region is very rich, not only in energy, but also mineral resources, a lot of which are in the Russian Arctic, Zisk had said. There are also very well-preserved fish stocks that are valuable considering the growing food crisis in the world. In addition, there is potential for a lucrative economic future as a transport hub. The Northern Sea Route that runs along Russia's northern coast is currently blocked by ice for most of the year. But if it weren't, it could become a highly profitable shipping channel. For example, shipping times and fuel costs for transporting goods between China and Europe would be cut dramatically if they could travel via the Arctic instead of the current route via South Asia and through the Suez Canal. And these possible future scenarios have increased international interest in the Arctic. In addition to the 8 core members with territories in the Arctic, the Arctic Council also has 13 council observers that can propose projects in the region. And these include France, Germany, the United Kingdom, and most notably China, which has been actively setting up Arctic research stations and investing in mining and energy. The international interest in the riches of the Arctic has also compelled Russia to play a more dominant role in the region. Quote, it has been stimulating Russia to strengthen its position because Russia sees itself as the leading actor in the Arctic, and for good reason, if you look at the geography, Zisk had said. So far, however, there seems to be little appetite from Russia to extend this role of military the clashes in the far north states against each other. My reading is that Russia has been actually trying to avoid escalation, Zisk had said, following NATO exercises with Finland and Sweden in early March. And NATO troops participated in another exercise in Norway on March 25, and the Russia response was muted. It released a statement in protest and conducted its own military training exercises on the same day. So Russia always protests when NATO does military exercises close to its border, Zisk said, but we haven't seen any provocative behavior from Russia in the Arctic. I think Russia is actually trying to avoid escalating international reaction to the conflict in Ukraine, and also its military is already fully engaged there. Among Western allies, too, the war in Ukraine may prove to be a turning point for political relations to the Arctic, but not necessarily a rupture. And the Arctic Council has paused temporarily its work, but it's not breaking apart, Garson said. So in a part of the world dominated by such a challenging natural landscape, it might be that the necessity for collaboration and cooperation between the Arctic states ultimately overrides political tension. The Arctic is governed by quite a complex web of bilateral and multilateral agreements, and I think the nations will be careful of walking away from them too quickly, Garson said. There will be a will for political cooperation. So that's the story. That's the end of our time together today. Thanks for being with us. Tomorrow is Wednesday. I don't even remember who's on for Wednesday, and I don't have the time to look. You take care. And we'll give you notice on the website. Be well and goodbye. Thanks for being with us.